The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore, and greetings to everyone and to those that are attending with us technically, electronically. Let's go over to Matthew 27 today. I want to thank Mr. Quinn for his reading today. I'm glad we were able to get it very clear and appreciated that. Once heard a humorous story, at least it was to me. The Pope was on a visit to America in this story. On the last day of his visit, he was delayed because of a number of meetings, and he felt he was unable to break away for the ride he was supposed to get to the airport. So as a result, he went ahead and phoned and called for a limousine to come and pick him up. And when the limousine driver arrived at the meeting place there, he was pretty surprised to see who it was who had called for a limousine. And he became very, very nervous over the passenger that he had with him. So he was driving real slow. And I think also he kind of had this desire to, keep the Pope with him as long as he possibly could. He was an avid Catholic, of course. So he was going slower and slower. Finally, the Pope was getting so frustrated that he wasn't going to make his plane that he said, look, let's switch. I'll drive. You sit in back. So the Pope gets in the limousine, and he starts driving, and he's going over the speed limit, and a policeman pulls him over and stops him. You know, and the policeman's a little shocked to see who's behind the wheel here, and he frantically phones the chief of police, and he says, I stopped somebody here and for speeding, and I really don't know exactly what to do. And the chief says, well, what do you mean you don't know what to do? Give him a ticket for speeding, you know. And he says, can't you just do that, you know? It's the law is the law, after all. Who is it you stopped? And he said, well, I'm not sure who the man is, he said, but he must be very important because the Pope is driving him to the airport. Yeah, that's a cute story in a way. You know, the officer thought the man in the back was really important. He may have thought he was even Christ, and the Pope was driving him to the airport. I don't know, anyway. But the reason I went through this story is because I want to talk today about substitution. That we had a case here where the Pope is substituting himself for the driver, and the driver substituting himself for the Pope. He becomes the passenger. And there are times in life when substitutes can really be a good thing. I know there are people that they have trouble with having too much salt, and so they have salt substitutes. And there's people that sugar does them a lot of damage. And so they use a sugar substitute. And there can be times when these things are really good for us. But there's other times that the substitutes can actually do more damage than they do help us. And in life, we've got to be very careful, I believe, when we make certain substitutions in our lives. So my issue today is this. There are times when we substitute error for truth. There are times when we substitute doing that which is our will for doing that which is God's will. So if you remember, there was this man named Barabbas. And that means son of the father, interestingly enough. And he was scheduled to be beaten and crucified the same day as Christ. And their paths crossed. And at that time, Pilate asked the people, because there was this tendency to let somebody go free, and he asked who it should be. And the people traded one for the other. Instead of freeing the man who was innocent, they freed the man who was guilty, and they crucified or called for the crucifixion. Matthew 27 of the man who was innocent. Matthew 27 and verse 15. Matthew 27. Matthew 27 and verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whoever they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Who will you that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. He knew he wasn't guilty of anything. And when he was set down in the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. So evidently she couldn't sleep her afternoon nap there, her morning sleep-in time, because she was disturbed by dreams. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And the governor answered and said unto them, whether of the twain will you that I release unto you? And they said, Barabbas. And Pilate said unto him, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? And they all said to him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil has he done? But they cried out even the more, saying, Let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this blood of this just person. See you to it. Then answered all the people, and they said, His blood be on us and on our children. What a horrible thing to consign your children to. Then released he Barabbas unto them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. To me, this is so typical of humanity. We will often substitute something evil for that which is good. And here were these people that saw Christ's miracles. They ate of the food that he created. They saw the people that he healed and gave life to them again and a quality of life. And they saw all of this, and yet they chose the bad rather than that which was good. Now, I say this because in certain ways, I think that we can apply this to the church in the last days, you know. I think that in many cases, we are making wrong kinds of substitutions. And so many times, we are substituting things that are physical pleasures in particular, in place of those things that are Christ and those things that belong to the kingdom of God. And let me give you an example. We know about the early church, and they were filled with zeal, and they were stirred with passion by a vision they held inside, and that was a vision of the kingdom of God and them being a part of it. And then after things didn't go their way, there followed ambivalence. Believers were expecting the kingdom to come in their time, and when it didn't, they let down. They lost their first love. But when we do that, we do this. We turn our interest in another direction. So they substituted one thing for another thing is what they did. And so Christ, I want to remind us, especially in light of the reading today, that Christ never said that he was going to come in their time. Paul and Peter may have assumed that, but the Jews of that time knew that God had a 6,000-year plan that would end with a 1,000-year millennium, and the Jewish encyclopedia says this, a verse 1,000 years in thy sight are but yesterday, having suggested the idea that the present world of toil is to be followed by a sabbatical millennium, the world to come. Of these, the 6 millenniums were again divided into 3 periods, the first 2,000 years devoid of the law, the next 2,000 years under the rule of law, and the last 2,000 years preparing amid struggles and catastrophes for the rule of the Messiah to finally come. The Jews all knew this was the truth. Even so, after Christ was crucified, what did Peter do? He was risen. He had talked to them, and he said, well, I go fishing. It didn't turn out the way I thought, so I'm going to go back, and I'm going to put my career first, and I'll substitute that for all that I'm called to do later. He would realize the mistake he had made, and he would write, as we read today, that a day is like 1,000 years, and he's referring back to Psalm 90, verse 4, and the Talmudic teaching that had existed for some time of a 7,000-year plan. So there's no question, though, that this phenomena happens to all of us from time to time. Whenever we don't get what we expect and we hope for, there is some kind of depression that follows. And when that depression follows, it brings with us a letdown, a loss of interest in what we were pursuing. Sometimes it ends up in an ambivalence in us, too. And so this is something that shows up as a half-hearted attitude and something that we've got to be aware of because of the times we live in particular. So let's go to Revelation 3, if we will. Revelation 3. You know, this has happened in our era of the church, and we have had a similar occurrence that we thought things were going to work out a certain way. A lot of us perhaps thought Christ was going to come in our lifetime, and he didn't. And so there was some kind of letdown that all of us, I think, experienced, you know. There was a messenger sent, and he built a work, and we were a part of that work, and we had certain expectations and certain hopes and certain dreams. And when he died, as it says, smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. And so we got scattered, and we got distracted by so many things in our lives. And so we have turned, in many cases, to other things to fulfill us. And many lost their zeal for the kingdom. In Revelation 3 and verse 16. So then, because you are lukewarm, he says, and neither hot or cold, I'll spew you out of my mouth. So you understand what happened is that people are, they aren't lukewarm in their whole life, but they're lukewarm in those things that pertain to seeking the kingdom, those things that are in the Bible. They've become lukewarm to these things because in many cases people substituted a career for their calling. And I watched that happen as people started to say, well, I better go back to school, you know, I better get a degree, I better do this, I'm going to do this. Everybody was making plans what we were going to do because what we thought was going to happen didn't happen. And so this is what we did. We substituted, you know. And so as a result, many of our church members are way better off today than they ever were before. And those people who live in big cities are driving pretty nice cars and living in decent houses and so on. In verse 17, because you say I'm rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, don't you know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, and blind, and naked? No, we don't know because we lost our focus. And that's the problem. And so this is something that has happened to us church-wide, and it's happened to varying degrees. To some it's happened more, and to others it's happened less. And I am not accusing those people that have money of being Laodicean. I am not accusing people who have wealth of being Laodicean. Abraham had wealth. You know, Joseph had wealth. Many of the people down through the ages who obeyed God had wealth. But I'm talking to another group, and that is a group of people that do exist in today's society that are in the Church of God, that held on to their faith, but they redirected a lot of their effort into their careers, into upward mobility, into having stuff and things and all kinds of other interests that developed in their lives. And the reason this is a problem is this. There's only so much time in life. The time is like money we put in a bank, and there's so much there, and you can draw it out, and then there's no more left. And my point is that we've got less time today for prayer. We've got less time for study. We've got less time for intimacy with God. And as a result, our relationship with him is not as intense. It is not as close. It's not what it should be. We've substituted too many other things in our lives that have taken away from that tremendous zeal and calling that we have. So we go to church every week and we dress well, you know, and we look the part and we serve sometimes as elders and deacons in the Church of God. And yet we're not lukewarm concerning the things even that we do in the church. You get it? That's my point. We may be highly involved in what we do in the church. We may be promoting our church, promoting the things our church teaches. That's not the issue. My issue is, have we substituted doing things in the church, religious things, for a relationship, an intimate relationship with God, in which we seek that kingdom more than anything else. Isn't it ironic that seeking religious activities can become a substitute for seeking God? But it can. People are in churches for many different reasons. And this is what I think has happened to so many people today. And so he says here in verse 18, I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in the fire that you may be rich, white raiment that you may be clothed, and that the shame of your nakedness does not appear. And anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. In other words, when we are not fully focused on the kingdom, when that isn't the first thing that we think about in the morning and the last thing we think about at night, when it isn't the driving force behind us, our vision becomes somewhat blurred. And so we need eye salve to see. We don't even see what's happened to ourselves because the process can happen so slowly. And so we're warned about this, and he's counseling these people at the end, you know, buy gold tried in the fire, that is, buy righteous character. He wants us to be clothed with white linen, that is, with righteousness. And he does not want us to substitute what he has called us to for something that's physical. And perhaps one of the things that bothers me the most is this. And that is that there are churches out there claiming that they are the one and only true church. And of course, everybody wants to be in the true church. Nobody wants to be in a false church. It's understandable. But it's ironic for this reason. We are already in God's church. When we were baptized into God's church and not some sect or denomination and nothing made by men. And I just want us to all remember that. That was our focus. And now it's become something else. And people are claiming they're the one and only true church. And some human corporation has some meaning, which people we associate with and what's being taught does matter. But it has far less meaning than we really give it credit for. What really matters is our individual personal relationship with Christ. That's what really matters the most. So people buy into this belief of being the one and only true church are substituting loyalty towards men or loyalty towards an organization for loyalty that belongs only to Christ. Substituting a sense of acceptance for righteousness. Replacing a relationship with Christ with loyalty to other men. And this can be what I think is a terrible trap to fall into. Let's go to 1 Samuel 22. People give away something that is really vitally important. Something so vitally important, we'll give it away for something of so much less value. 1 Samuel 22. And it's amazing sometimes how far it will go. Loyalty to church instead of loyalty to God. Loyalty to a person instead of loyalty to God. I want you to think about the loyalty that the Israelites had for King Saul. He was the leader at the time, but he hated David because David was more popular than he was. And so he began to pursue David with the intent of killing him and destroying him. And while David ran, he ran at one point to the high priest, and he said that these guys were famished. They had been without any food for about 3 days. And he inquired through the high priest if he could eat the showbread. And God, who was the person that became Christ, gave him permission to eat it. Now, Doeg was an Edomite, and he was there, and he watched the whole thing going on. He watched what occurred. When Saul came to him, Doeg wanted to earn points with Saul. He cared more about his own relationship with this leader than he did about truth. And in his loyalty to Saul, he abandoned any loyalty to God. So for physical acceptance and recognition, he sold out. And Samuel records the circumstances here in verse 9 through 18. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and his father's house, and the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, Hear now, you son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and you've inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me and lie in wait as to this day? And of course, he wasn't doing any of those things. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who is so faithful among all your servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goes at thy bidding, and is honorable in all thy house? In other words, you know, there isn't anybody better than David and more loyal to you than him. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor all the house of my father, for the servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. So this isn't the first time David came to inquire of me. He's come to me all the time to inquire of God. You know, this isn't something that I haven't always done. And so I didn't know anything about any of this. And the king said, You shall surely die, and Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. And the king said unto the footman that stood about him, Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and did not show it unto me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, Turn you and fall on the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priests, and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear the linen ephod. Do you understand what's happening here? He sold out for something. There was something else. He substituted his own recognition, his own need to be accepted by Saul and maybe get a position with Saul, and he slew 85 priests to do it. Can you imagine that? It's hard to imagine, isn't it, that someone would do that, you know? And you wonder sometimes, why didn't somebody say stop? Why didn't somebody say no? Why didn't those men, instead of just not saying, just standing down, why didn't they intervene and stop Doeg from doing this? Why didn't they do it? Well, there's a reason. There's a reason. And that's because the people are so tied to Saul. They were so tied to him. They thought their future depended on him and not God. Now, do you see why I talk about people that say they're the one and only true church? Because that's the same thing. People are tying themselves to a man and loyalty to a man instead of God. You know, today we see the news media doing almost the very same thing. Today no one seems to stand up against the infraction that was done or the inaction taken in Benghazi. You know, nobody really will stand up. Nobody. We should be shouting from the rooftops. We should be telling the things that are really going on, and yet the media is covering these things up. Because why? Because they don't want to be sidelined. Because they don't want to lose their job. Because they don't want to lose their recognition as a player with one of these big companies. That's what it is. It's the same exact thing that's going on here. And it's a trade-off. It's a substitute. And it's so dangerous sometimes to see this kind of thing happening. It's like Nazi Germany of the past. How far is it going to go? Our dedication, our loyalty to some leader or some organization cannot ever count more than our loyalty to the Almighty God. We've got to put our loyalty to Him. You know, very few people stood up in worldwide because they knew they were going to lose something, a job or a car or their income or something like that, you know. And still, people want, Everybody wants to be able to do this, to identify themselves as some human being that is of importance, somebody who has some wealth or somebody that has status. They want to tie themselves to that person and ride in to success on their coattails. And that's happening over and over and over again. But whenever that happens, something has to be substituted in order to go that route. Something has to go. Psalm 62, if you will. Psalm 62, few feel they can stand up to some kind of wrong that's in the church today. And that's why I think it's a good thing that we have a Q&A the way that we do and that you can even challenge. And I think we should do it respectfully and all of that, whatever we do. But still, that was not a possibility in the past. And that's part of the reason, I believe, that things went awry as fast as they did. You know, but what if we don't stand for the truth when it comes time to lose something? What if that happens? What are we going to tell the faithful martyrs? What are we going to tell the prophets of old that suffered and some lost their lives? You know, I'm telling you, we've got to think this thing through. What if we give some allegiance to one man and he says, because his work is crumbling, and he says, you know, it's time to go to safety, and so we all go to the Middle East or something. You understand, thousands of people might go because they trust one man. But thousands of people could be harmed terribly because it isn't of God. You have to know that God's going to take care of us, not some man. In the end, Bin Laden's living in well someplace, you understand? Castro's living well. You know, all these tyrants and dictators and the people that tell you to go and blow yourself up, they're all living well and they're safe. And that's the way it always is. And so tying ourselves to some man is not going to save us ever, because it isn't in man to do the right thing. Psalm 62 and verse 9 says something really intriguing. Surely men of low degree are vanity, but men of high degree are a lie. Letting my light shine over there. Do you understand what he's saying? Men of high degree are a lie, because we are nothing. We are just clay. No matter what status we have here, it doesn't surpass the status of John the Baptist. Hold it right there. Nope, that's not it. Okay, back again. I didn't want to sacrifice the whole sermon for a blinking light. You know? Look, if we're correct about eras, there will not be a man sent until the tribulation occurs. Then he's going to send two witnesses. Remember how long their ministry is? 1,260 days. And how long is the church in a place of safety? 1,260 days. When we get messengers sent from God, apostles sent from God to do a work, we're already, those who are faithful are going to be in a place of safety, because they're going to prove themselves on their own between themselves and God. Not between themselves and some church, and not between themselves and some church leader, and not between themselves and some congregation or some company or anything like that. It's going to be because they prove themselves to God. And that's what we have to understand as we go through this road that we're traveling to the kingdom. You and I were taught the truth a long time ago. And now it's only right that God wait and see what we're going to do with that truth, isn't it? And that's what's happening now. We've got to be striving to live the truth in our individual lives. It's not enough to know the right doctrines. It is not enough. It's not enough to be in the right church or have faith in the right church. You know, and that's why I asked earlier, what are we going to tell them? What are we going to tell them? You know, like these people in Worldwide that said I had to preach safe sermons, you know. You know, do we believe that Abraham really had to kill his son? Do we believe that Rahab put her life on the line? Do we really believe that Isaiah was sawn in half? Do we really believe that Christ was beaten within an inch of his life and unrecognizable and finally crucified? Do we believe that they had to go this far and they had some kind of other interests that counted to them more? How are we going to answer them? Well, we had to be careful what we said. You know, we had to be careful how we played it, you know, in the end, so that we didn't get in any trouble. You understand? These people should have stood up and saved those priests. And our media should stand up for the truth of America. And you and I need to stand up for the truth no matter where we are and live it. Not stand up and browbeat everybody or harangue everybody or put down everybody, but stand up by living the truth to the very best of our ability with God's help. So what will we tell the people that came before us when we ultimately face them? Well, we had to be careful. We might be ostracized. So people are taught that they must go to the right church, corporation, and all they have to do is stay within the church guidelines. But they substitute what I call groupthink for individual relationship. And the Pharisees, that's exactly what they did, wasn't it? That's exactly what they did. They knew they were in the right group. They had the truth. They had God's truth. And they had their spoken and they had their unspoken rules that everybody knew. 1 Peter 1. So people thought if they followed these leaders that they would be in good stead. And so they would follow them. But yet Christ called those leaders hypocrites is what he said. And they put their organization and they put their rules above God. And then what do we see later? The Catholics do the same thing, don't they? The people believe that they've got to be a Catholic in order to ever go to heaven. And yet at the same time, they put their rules before God's rules over and over. The Protestants do it too. They teach that you have to believe in the Trinity, something that's not even mentioned in the Bible. You have to believe in that. Then you have to believe that Christ gives you freedom from keeping the law. You know, but they all have their rules that validate themselves and so on, or they validate an individual. Can you imagine, you know, you go in Catholic Church, you have to know how to genuflect. You have to know how to do the sign of the cross. You have to know how to do all these things, and some people are very adamant. Mel Gibson thinks they should have the service in Latin. And so they have all these rules that are sometimes spoken and sometimes unspoken. And in some churches, they have hair lengths and skirt lengths and those kind of rules, and then speaking in tongues. But you understand, it can't be any of this stuff for us. There is no secret dress code. And I remember people had that dress code, you know, and it had to be a burgundy briefcase and wingtip shoes and certain kind of suit, you know, that you had to wear. And it was propagated within the Church of God. And I'm going, none of this matters. None of it matters. And it's in retrospect, as I get older, it's almost something to laugh about, that people would think that these things really mattered. What really matters is our relationship to God and how we're striving to live, what we think about from day to day. It's not about following some church leader for certain. 1 Peter 1, verse 13. Wherefore, he says, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts and your ignorance, but as he which has called you is holy, so be you holy in all your manner of conduct. Because it's written, be you holy, for I am holy. And if you call on the Father, who without respect of persons, he has no respect of persons, he judges according to every man's work. So therefore, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. That is, you should be, and I should be considering what we do and whether or not it's going to offend God. We should think that, shouldn't we? Is this going to offend God? But we don't think that way often. We want what we want, and we make a trade. We get what we want, okay? But we have to give something up for it, and that's doing God's will. But we need to be sober and live it with a certain amount of fear of going against, giving God lip service, for example, just going against what he says to do. And so salvation is about striving, seriously striving to be holy. It's about seriously working, actively working at ways to become holy. And it's about eventually becoming spirit being and being included in the very family of God. And this is a very intimate experience that we're going through, this conversion. God's working in our heart. He's in our mind. He can feel what we think, and He knows what we think and feel. Understand, this is intimacy with God. And my point is that it doesn't include other people, other churches, or other organizations, you know, in that relationship. There are relationships with an organization. There are relationships with other people. But my point is that the one we have with God is between us and God, and our decisions that we make need to be based on that relationship and not about what other people think or what other people command or what other people say we have to do. It's what God says. So it brings me to another situation that I want to talk about. Some people think that what we believe is all important. For example, each splinter group in the Church of God has to have something unique about them to attract other people. So each one has to offer something different, and they all have to have a unique doctrine. And so we see calendar doctrines, we see sacred names doctrines, and unique views on prophecy and all of that. And some of this attracts different people, and some of it, propels others away. You know, but my point is that by having this other doctrine, this thing that they believe that they know about and nobody else knows, it makes them feel superior in their mind, more righteous than others, and it gives them what they think is the right to judge other people. And I remember a few years ago this happened to me, and it just rings in my mind, and that is, a minister called me, he says, call your attack dogs off. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I was giving a Bible study, and he said, two of your guys came in, and they raised their voice, and they were attacking me in front of everybody about Sabbath test. And I said, I don't know these guys. I said, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I believe in Sabbath test and so on. But the point is that we aren't supposed to use these scriptures that we find in the Bible. Yes, we know some doctrine, and we know it's true, and we know that we're on one level and they're on another level, but we were on that level at one time ourselves, you understand? It isn't up to us to beat the truth into somebody else's head. We're not to use these scriptures to, show people that we're smarter or we know more than them or that put other people down. And I've seen this happen over and over again. I remember there was a deacon up in Tehachapi that he talked to me about this years ago, and he said, Art, you know, in these marriage situations, you know, the woman the man will read the scripture and says, I'm the head of the house, you know, and the woman will, read the scripture about love your wives, you know, and read it to each other. And he says, it's not supposed to be like that. The man is never supposed to read that scripture to his wife. That is written from God to his wife. That's God speaking to the wife, not you trying to use it to pound her into getting your way, you understand? And so it is that loving your wife is God saying that to us. I think he had a lot of wisdom there, that we shouldn't use the scriptures to try to get our way or pound somebody over the head with it, you know. Matthew 7. So anyway, I didn't even know how to get in touch with those guys. I'm really sorry that they did that, but you understand they made fools of the doctrine that they so strongly believed in just by their behavior. And so, you know, they must have gotten a momentary thrill of seeming smarter than the minister, and he couldn't answer their questions or whatever, but they substituted that for the correct kind of behavior, which is to live it and be an example to others. And so I hope everybody understands my point. You and I, we've been given an enormous gift. If we know something, we didn't make it up. We didn't design it. It was given to us as a gift, and we need to understand that. And we should stand up for it by living the truth that it points us to. And we're not to use God's word as a club in any sense. So you understand this point. You understand this point. Do you think that dog is a fan, or do you think he doesn't like what I'm saying? Anyway, would you? Yeah. Knowing something different about prophecy that others don't know, you know, knowing perhaps some deep, more deeply embedded facets of God's truth is a wonderful thing, you know, but it only has meaning if we strive to use it to help ourselves conform to the way of God and the image of Christ. It's not going to do us any good to believe it. But a lot of people have this idea that if I believe this, and if I believe this doctrine, and this is the true doctrine, this is the true calendar, this is the true way to speak God's name, if we believe it, then we're in. We got a ticket into the kingdom or a ticket into the place of safety. But that's not the truth at all. Matthew 7, verse 22. Many will say to me that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in your name cast out many devils? And in your name done many wonderful works, and I'll profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. And so that we know that the word iniquity is lawlessness. And so the point is this, that we've got to be striving to become the law in our minds and in our hearts. Isaiah 5. Isaiah 5, I think, says it as clear as it can be said. We can't think that knowing a certain doctrine is going to be the answer. Following a certain church is going to be the answer. Having special knowledge, any of that kind of thing. Isaiah 5. You know, people do these religious things in life. All these religious things, they serve others and they do it sometimes for the wrong reasons. You know, it might just be for our own ego that we do some of the things that we do, and we've got to consider some of this. We may not realize it at first. You know, we may not see that the rich man is really a lie. It doesn't buy you anything. You may have status among men, but you don't among God. He's looking at a whole different grading system. But we see this played out in a number of ways in different people's lives. And Isaiah 5 and verse 20 says this so clearly, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, and put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. You know, this is something God hates. You start mixing things up and you start making your trade-offs, and pretty soon you end up with poison. And that's the way it is. You know, there was a story I once heard that I think I'll repeat here that is kind of interesting. There was a man who had a ranch and a farm and stuff, and he was wanting to cut costs, and so he began to add a little sawdust in with the food that he was giving and with the meal he was giving his mule. And it seemed to work for a while, you know. The mule seemed to accept it, and he seemed no better or no worse for it. And so he continued to do it, and he added a little bit more sawdust, and pretty soon the next thing he knew, his mule was sick, and his mule died, and then he could no longer had an animal to plow his fields. And so you understand my point is that you can just add a little bit in, substitute a little bit here and a little bit there, and after a while you can get sick spiritually, and you can even die. And so it's something to think about. It's something to think about, spiritually sick. I think all of us see those things that are going on all around us, that is in the news and around our world, you know. But my question today is, okay, I've demonstrated some ways that I'm sure you can all agree with that you see in other churches and other places and that you've seen going on in the Church of God. And you see them when they're outside. But my question today is, what about inside? What if I get a little bit more personal with this? Because God gave us the first commandment. And that first commandment simply states, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, why do you think he would say that first? Why do you think he would even have to say that? Because we all put things before God, don't we? We all have something before God. And who is it? What is it? It's us, isn't it? We put ourselves before God all the time. And God is telling us, It's about me, meaning him. It's about him. It's not about us. It's about what he's doing with us. That's what really matters, and that's what really counts. And we've got to remember this all of our life, that our ego is not the center of the universe. You know, I ask you this. I want you to think about it. Just take a moment. Every one of us, even during the sermons, everybody drifts into reverie, don't we? We get in the car to go to the store, and we drift into reverie, right? We go back and we start, we just kind of drift into thinking about what I should have said the other day, what I should have done. It's about our world, isn't it, always? Aren't we always thinking about thoughts about ourselves? We are, aren't we? Why is that? Because we make ourselves God. We think that the world revolves around us. At least our world does. And we can't see. We're so short-sighted, you know. People are dying on the East Coast, you know. They've got no water. They're afraid. They're scared. They got no power. They don't know where they're getting the next meal from. A cold front's coming in, a cold storm. But I got things to do, you know. I'm thinking about me and what I have to do, what I'm going to do, and what I'm going to get out of it. We all think about what we want to get in life. We rehash what we should have done or should have said or how it could have made it better. You have to admit the human mind is a wonderful thing. We can make an excuse to substitute for every error we've ever made. There's always a rational justification. You know, we are so good at this, you know. So my point is, you understand we do this and it's wrong, and that we should be using our time to meditate, not reverie. It's okay to reverie once in a while, fall into that. Of course, we have a life to live. But why aren't we sometimes spending more of that time meditating, you know? I know there's people, when it comes to prayer, I know there's a lot of people that say, well, I pray every day, but they do it on their driving down to work. To me, that's meditation, you know, and that's good. You should do that. But I still think that if we go day after day without getting on our knees before God and humbly realizing we're coming before his throne with myriad of angels and great power and enormous glory, I think we're missing something. I think we're missing something about our attitude and our relationship to who it is we really serve. And so I don't want us to forget this and substitute it for, I got to get there on time, I got to do this, I have this and that, and I this and I that and I the other. You know, it's not all about us. So we can do things for the wrong reasons. And I know there are times when people will make sacrifices for others. And sometimes they've done it because they wanted others to think that they were good for doing it. You know, there are ministers out there. I see them on television all the time. You know, they became ministers. What do you think they became ministers for? To build a cult personality about them. And people copy them, you know? And that's what they do that for, not to serve God. You know, they do it for all kinds of reasons that are about them, you know? Using God for our own purposes. Can you imagine using God to make money? Look at what the Pharisees did. Look at what we do on the TV evangelists. Look at what we do in our lives. You know, so we do something on a much minor scale. We substitute entertainment for Bible study. We replace right actions by substituting excuses, and we justify our actions, and we don't easily admit we're ever wrong. You know, in so many cases, TV replaces real communication in our lives together. And I think this is another thing that's just a substitute that is hollow to me. You know, TV can make you happy, makes you feel happy, and it makes you feel sad, and it makes you feel compassionate, and it makes you feel hope, and it makes you laugh, you know? It makes you feel really alive, but it's not real. It's not real. And we substitute that for communication with one another, for intimacy with other human beings on a real and meaningful level. But you see, it's taken the place. It's substituted. I want to go to some place we were at earlier, and that is 2 Peter 3, 2 Peter 3 and verse 13. I want us to ask ourselves, because of this, the time is drawing near. It's getting closer. And I think it's time for us to take our head out of the sand, as it were. And honestly, ask ourselves this question. What is it do you want? What do you really want? If you ask yourself that question, what do you really want? What are you after? What do you think about the most? And it gives you an indication. You understand what I'm saying? To exercise this examination of ourselves and to look into our mind and ask ourselves, what are we really after? And see how much of it is really about God's kingdom. What are we seeking? What's primarily on our mind? And therefore it says, nevertheless, we according to his promise look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Do we? Is that what we look for? Is that what we really want? Good. Good. But not always. I'm saying this has to be our prime motivator in our life. 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13. It's time to be honest with ourselves, really, because we're running out of time. Here we are on this beautiful earth. We have this fantastic calling that we have. We actually know the purpose for all of it, the purpose and reason for life. You know, and in reality, it's all within our reach if that's what we want. But so many times we substitute something cheap and inferior for it. So what are we doing? Are we trying to strive to satisfy something that's within ourselves? Are we trying to make ourselves happy? Is that what it's about? Is that what life is about? Is that why we're here? Can we ever be made happy, you know? Because I think there's only one thing that can make us happy, and I think we are substituting the temporary for the permanent, the physical for the spiritual, 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity, I'm become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains, and I don't have charity, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profits me nothing. Charity suffers long and is kind. It envies not. It doesn't vaunt itself. It's not puffed up and vain. It doesn't behave itself unseemly. It doesn't think unseemly. Doesn't talk trashy talk. It doesn't seek or own. It's not so easily provoked. It doesn't think evil of the other person. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Yes, and it bears all things and believes the best things. And it hopes for the very best and it endures all things. Charity never fails. Whether there be prophecies, they'll fail. Whether there be tongues, they'll cease. Whether there be knowledge, it will all vanish away. But we know in part and prophesy in part. And when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part shall be done away. And so it says again, the greatest of these is charity, and that is love. Godly love is what he's striving to build in us. That's what we've got to be thinking about. That's what we've got to be responding from. And that's what's got to be motivating us. Christ is knocking on our door. He wants to come in. And he wants to be a part of our thoughts and a part of our lives and a part of what motivates us. And he wants to give us life, real life, abundant life, eternal life. The question is, what do we want? What do we really want? John Maxwell wrote this in a book called The Leader Within You. And he tells about the building of the Great Wall of China. And it was interesting when I read about this that they built that wall in China. They were going to build it so high, no one could ever climb over it. They were going to build it so thick, no one could ever tunnel through it. And they sat there peaceably and comfortably on the other side of that wall, believing that they were in safety. But you know what? They were invaded three times. You know why? Because somebody on the inside opened the gate and let the enemy through. So you understand my point today? That you and I have gates of doctrines we believe. You and I have gates in our mind. We know that we should shut this out and we should shut that out. But sometimes we allow the enemy to come in and we substitute a wrong thought for a right thought. And we let the enemy in. And we could be conquered by doing such a thing. And so I remind us today of all these things that are external. Let's examine ourselves internally. And as the world degenerates all around us, as it swirls in its downward spiral, let's not accept substitutes for the real thing.